Welcome to this issue of the AANS podcast. It's not brain surgery, the practice and business management podcast of the AANS. And today it's our honor to welcome to the podcast Dr. Jim Rutka. Dr. Rutka is from Toronto, educated at Princeton University, did his internship at McGill and entered neurosurgery training at the University of Toronto, received his PhD at the University of California, San Francisco in experimental pathology, and really has risen through the ranks as professor of neurosurgery at Toronto, from chair of the Division of Neurosurgery and eventually chair of the Department of Surgery as well. And he's been the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neurosurgery for the last 10 years. Has received a number of other honors and awards, both from international and national neurosurgery, president of the AANS, president of the World Academy, and the Academy of Neurological Surgeons. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's great to hear from you and also to see you on our Zoom connection today, and happy to speak to you about our task at hand today.
Yes. So Dr. Rutka is joining us in his capacity as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neurological Surgery. Jim, first of all, how do you find time to do all of this? Knowing how difficult it is to run a department, run a division, and be editor-in-chief, I mean, my goodness, you must get thousands of emails a week even.
Well, Paul, thanks very much. Yeah, we're busy, all of us. And, you know, I had four jobs. So the department chair, I had my, you know, clinical practice at SickKids. I ran my research laboratory and I'm editor-in-chief of the journal. So as I look back on the last 10 years, I actually don't know how I managed to squeeze it all in, but somehow it seemed to come together without too many balls falling. And it's been wonderful. I mean, I can't complain. It's been a spectacular career I've had. And everything I've done has had meaning, has been a real privilege to be a part of. So yeah, you find the time. But I must say, with the journal work, as you were asking, it's a labor of love because it's relentless. It never stops. It's a fire hose that's always directly in your face. You have to be available and ready day in, day out, including on weekends. So yeah, I mean, I've just lived with it now, as you mentioned, about the last decade. I plan to do this job for another couple of years, but it's a real privilege to be able to have the world's manuscripts for neurosurgery in your hands every day of the week. And I never forget how much of a privilege that actually is.
Well, I'm sure I joined thousands of neurosurgeons across the world in thanking you for the amazing job that you do with the journal. And today, he's going to help us wade through a few articles that he's carefully selected. To those of us who don't spend all of our time or enough time reviewing articles in the literature, he's chosen a few salient articles that he thinks are of particular interest. So if you would, Dr. Rutka, take us through maybe the first of these. I have them in order with intracranial complications of hypercoagulability and superinfection in the setting of COVID-19 illustrative cases.
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. So, you know, I selected one article from each of the journals that we have for the Journal of Neurosurgery. This one's interesting because it's from the Journal of Neurosurgery Case Lessons, a relatively new journal that we've established for JNS. And it's because these days it's very hard, as you know, to publish case reports. Most journals aren't interested in case reports, but I actually think that publishing case reports are extremely important, especially for the residents and fellows on our services who rotate, because it helps them to organize their thoughts around a scientific issue. It allows them to go through the construct of preparing a manuscript and submitting it to a journal. And I think there's still a place for publishing case reports. And we call this one Case Lessons because it's formatted in a way that at the end, you can actually hear or see what the case lesson is for a particular manuscript. And this one is on the hypercoagulability, as you mentioned, in the setting of COVID-19. And I selected this one because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which, although we're emerging from, we've lived through. And as you know, it's been very challenging on all of us to practice our neurosurgical volumes and cases in the setting of the specter of COVID-19. So this particular article deals with a number of kind of super infections that occurred in the setting of COVID-19. So a patient comes in with COVID-19 and is also found to have some other kind of infectious illness on top of the COVID-19 infection. And there are three illustrative cases that go hand in hand with this article that was published. And one of them deals with a child who has a sinus infection and intracranial obstruction of the superior sagittal sinus, and thrombosis, and all that that entails. And you know that these children can be very, very sick. Sure. This is a child who went on to have a decompressive craniectomy and ultimately made a decent but not a perfect recovery in the first case scenario. The second case was an adolescent teenage girl who had a similar kind of a thing with an extra axial central nervous system infection in the setting of COVID, and also had thrombosis of sinus. And then finally, the third case was a subdural collection that was found, again, infectious in the setting of COVID. And, you know, I think we're seeing a lot of intracranial infections, at least in my region of North America. And there was some question about whether, you know, all these types of screening tests that were being done, so the nasal swabs, you know, up the nose, and yeah, having possible, you know, contamination of the secondary contamination of the aerated sinuses as a possible downstream bad and side effect from COVID-19 testing. So the lesson from this manuscript is that this is still COVID-19. You have to be aware that this could present to your emergency room and then to your hospital, and that there are life-threatening neurosurgical types of infections that can occur in this setting, and how to manage these patients in this background, and how to avoid the very serious consequences, and to be very aggressive with them, as you are aware, to get them through, because if you can, they can make spectacular recovery. Some of the best patients in my practice are actually those that have had like subdural empyemas, and who have, even though they've needed like multiple operations, washouts, extensions of decompressive craniectomies, have made like really fantastic recoveries.
Were these cases all early in the COVID pandemic or more recent?
Yeah, I think sort of early on, mm-hmm, and accumulated over time. And that is something that we've been experiencing here in Toronto. I don't know what it's like for you in Kansas, if you've seen any kind of outbreaks like this. Yeah.
Well, so once again, this was from the Journal of Neurosurgery Case Lessons, and it's intracranial complications of hypercoagulability and superinfection in the setting of COVID-19. Another article that Dr. Rutka has chosen is the recent Everrun Registry. Could you discuss that, Jim? This was endovascular therapy versus microsurgical clipping in wide-necked aneurysms.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So yeah, this one I thought was important because it is kind of a registry-based analysis of wide neck aneurysms. And there were essentially three main centers that were involved in accumulating their cases of these types of aneurysms, and then doing a comparison of the outcomes after treatment was instituted. And the treatment included either clipping or coiling. So surgical approach, open surgical approaches, or endovascular therapy. And the reason why I thought this was important was because, you know, there's been a lot of publicity around the recent and also very important proliferation of endovascular devices and the way that they've been developing and being used in all sorts of circumstances, and actually moving into the domain of the open vascular surgeon and essentially replacing a lot of open vascular surgery for various types of aneurysms. But these wide neck aneurysms, as the article states, are a rather different beast altogether and require different thinking. And what was interesting, I thought, about this article is when you compared the two, so open surgical approaches and clipping versus the endovascular therapy, there was really no difference when the primary outcome was looked at, which is the modified Rankin scale at 1 year post-treatment. Now, that's a pretty blunt measurement at the end of 1 year, but it's a starting point anyway. And in this analysis, which included cases that were extracted from the BNI, also from Mount Sinai in New York, and also from University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, three good groups of like high volume open and endovascular type treatments. This is what they found in their analysis, which I thought was interesting and important because, yes, while the world is moving more and more towards minimally invasive and endovascular therapies, there's still a need for and absolutely important to remember the strengths that can be applied through really well done technical neurosurgeons who know how to do open clipping of aneurysm. So that's the reason why I brought that forward. And I thought it would be a good article for those on the line to review and to take a peek at, because it's giving us an indication that there's still a role for open surgery in some of these very complex aneurysmal cases.
And the treatment, the endovascular treatment, was a variety of methods, right? They used
It was left up to the discretion of those that were performing the procedure. Correct.
And the primary outcome measure again was clinical.
Modified Rankin at 1 year.
MRS. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, another one of these articles, it's good to know that at least at the present time, there appears to be equipoise in both treatments. It reminds me of the CREST trial and some other ones that come up with similar clinical outcomes. But that's certainly a very important article from the Journal of Neurosurgery, volume 137, Endovascular Therapy versus Microsurgical Clipping of Ruptured Wide-Necked Aneurysms. The next study that you chose was one from JNS Peds, the endoscopic third ventriculostomy revision after failure of initial ETV and choroid plexus cauterization. Take us through that.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So again, I selected from each of our print journals. So this one's from the Journal of Neurosurgery Pediatrics. The last one was from JNS itself. So this is from the Hydrocephalus Clinical Research Network. This has been a great group of pediatric neurosurgeons who've come together to study all aspects of hydrocephalus and shunting technologies and approaches to hydrocephalus, including endoscopic third ventriculostomy. And, people have said for a long time that the best shunt in the world is no shunt.
No shunt. Right?
So if you can avoid putting in a shunt, great. So initially, these patients were looked at for what happened after they had their ETV and their choroid plexus cauterization. And when they failed, the question posed by this group was, how successful is endoscopic third ventriculostomy? Now, you can imagine that after you've done an ETV and you've done choroid plexus cauterization and the hydrocephalus kind of runs its course, and if it fails and you get a repeat of the hydrocephalus presentation, that the anatomy is a bit scarred down, and to identify the floor of the third ventricle after you've done an ETV, initially NCPC, is sometimes pretty tricky. Yeah, so you have to be careful. You have to know what you're doing in this case. And so, the hypothesis of this study was that ETV revision would have a higher failure rate than ETV and choroid plexus cauterization by itself. And in fact, that's exactly what they were able to show in this study. And the overall success rate for this study, where after ETV and CPC, ETV was done, was quite low. And the initial success rate was 45%. So that was 228 of 508 patients, something like that. But at the end of the day, after they had those failures in those patients and they subjected them to a repeat ETV, they essentially found that it was a lower success rate. It was on the order of 29%. So you can only count on about a third of patients being good after a repeat ETV after initial ETV and CPC. So yes, you can forge ahead and try it. You get maybe a third of patients who will not need a shunt. Two-thirds will. But the question is, shunting does work. And VP shunts have been around a long time. They have a well-defined natural history, just like now we know about ETV. So I must say, as I'm getting older in my career and practice, I'll default to shunting, when I think that it's either really going to be difficult anatomy to understand, or, you've only got a 30% success rate here with repeat ETV. So I'll look at the cases carefully. And if I really study the sagittal MRI scan and I see that it looks favorable for ETV, once again, I might try it for sure. But I would not hesitate after failure to think about putting in a shunt after you've had at least one kick at the can. I guess that's the bottom line of this particular procedure.
And now you have some data behind it that you can talk to families and say, if you are experienced at this, we have at best a 30% success rate on the second time around.
Exactly.
and that shunting is not necessarily bad.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, shunting will, you know, be effective in 100% of the patients initially. Yeah. Of course, then you have the shunt failure rate, which is probably on the order of like 60% survival of shunts. And so maybe a 20-30% chance of a shunt blocking at some point during the lifetime of that individual.
So yet another really outstanding work from the Hydrocephalus Clinical Research Network in JNS PEDS. The fourth article you wanted to take us through is transtubular image-guided surgery for spinal intradural lesions, results in 60 patients from JNS Spine.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So this is the other print journal, JNS Spine, that you mentioned. And when I started neurosurgical practice 30 years ago, there was no such thing as transtubular surgery, not for That's spine right. anyway.
For sure.
And so we've come a long way. And I think it's all become about minimally invasive surgery to a degree for advanced spine technologies. So I like this one, not just because it's trans, like, tubular minimally invasive to get to the spine, but it's actually to go intradural in the spine and to remove tumors within the spine, you know, the spinal canal. So I thought this was a very interesting and bold approach. 60 patients were examined. In their approach, they used either 2D fluoroscopic image guidance or 3D image guidance. And they had actually very good outcomes in terms of what they were able to achieve. Gross total resection in 87%, subtotal resection in about 8% of patients. The amount of permanent or serious neurological outcome was very, very low. There was, I think, solitary patient who had a permanent neurological deficit of the 60 patients, and that was a nerve root issue, I believe. But essentially, this, I thought, was very good technology, and it really shows you how far we've been pushing the boundaries for minimal invasive spine surgery when you can take out a spinal tumor using these transtubular approaches and get an intradural resection with all the techniques that were applied in this particular article, I thought was excellent. So you have navigation-based technologies helping you here. You're angling towards the spine to have the best trajectory. You're then opening the dura under the microscope in the transtubular fashion. You're resecting the tumor, and then obviously you have to close afterwards and avoid complications like CSF leak and other issues that can arise. But the authors make the point that using this technology, what they can do is find the best bony window, especially for ventral placed spinal intradural tumors, like could be a meningioma in front of the spine. Fabulous to see the article demonstrate that, like the figures that were used to get that type of exposure. So I personally have not used transtubular for spine, Paul. I'm not sure if you have.
No, for intradural lesions. And I saw the picture. I mean, I did a case within the last couple of years, an intradural, absolutely completely ventral meningioma in the thoracic spine via a costo transversectomy approach, because I had to get so far lateral. And here they've got a tube way lateral, you know, looking at just that kind of lesion. So
So they're able to angle the tube, just as you said, in a way that you could avoid a costo transversectomy, because it's not a morbid procedure, but it's a big procedure,
incision.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And obviously these surgeons in Switzerland, I think the article was from Lausanne, are very experienced at this, but it just shows you where we're going.
I think so. And you know what? I think we're going to be seeing more and more of this in the future. And they mentioned some of the limitations of their particular study, small series. They had different image guidance strategies that they used. But they shared their results along with those that have previously been published on intradural tumors. And their particular outcomes stack up against what's been published previously. And only one series was larger than this one that had 60 patients in it. So a very solid series. And I thought really interesting technology. I'd really like to see this come even further along in terms of future applications.
Yes, from JNS Spine, volume 37, transtubular image guided surgery for intradural lesions. We'll have links to all of these in the podcast notes as well. And the last article to discuss today, principles and strategies for step-by-step AVM excision. And this is a neurosurgical focus article.
Yeah, so thanks, Paul. So again, neurosurgical focus this time around. This is a group in part from the Mayo with Giuseppe Lanzino. you know, this is a nuts and bolts paper. I selected this one mostly for the residents who might be listening in on this, because this is a great article to read if you want to understand how to do AVM surgery. And AVM surgery is at times complicated. But if you follow the steps that these authors outline, including the dissection, you know, attacking the main feeders, looking at the nidus and getting the nidus dissected, you know, being very careful with some of those fragile AVM vessels, looking out for something called Hashimoto's loops, right? These are the little vessels that go into the parenchyma and then come back into the AVM, and to recognize those as you're doing the dissection. The deep feeders, right? How to tackle those. And sometimes the most difficult challenge is when you get to those deep feeders, and if it's a, as they often are, ventricular base or coming out of the ventricle type of AVM, making sure that you've got the understanding of the regional cerebrovascular anatomy at the depth of the AVM so that you can deal with those deep feeders and be very careful with what you're doing with the ependyma, the ependymal veins that are nearby, and eventually getting the AVM completely resected. So this, I thought, was an excellent article for those wishing to start their careers learning how to resect AVMs. What's even best about this, and we're not going to be able to portray this well on this podcast, are the illustrations. And if look at those, Paul, they're brilliant. I thought they were excellent. Professional medical artist drew them in, and it's very nice to see how you stepwise, you know, take the initial feeders, leave the draining vein to the end. Really nice demonstration of the complex anatomy of each of these AVMs and the steps that you take to, you know, complete the task at hand.
Yeah, the illustrations are really superb. I think this is going to end up in the hands of all of my residents here shortly. I think, as you say, it's just a really good sort of nuts and bolts, step-by-step approach to taking out cortical AVMs.
And I just mentioned this whole issue of neurosurgical focus, Paul, was on AVMs. And some of them are more nuanced in dealing with a single topic from within a grouping of different types of AVMs. But this one, as mentioned, would really help set the stage for residents to understand the beginnings of how to tackle these complicated lesions. And, you know, they're at times formidable, but, you know, we can do a lot of good as neurosurgeons for those lesions that are indicated for surgical resection. Patients can be cured for life of their AVMs without the risk of bleeding. Obviously, as you study your AVMs and your patients that are coming into your practice, you have other options to consider. There's the interventional neurosurgery options. There are radiosurgery options and so on. But really, I thought this would be good because we still have a big role to play with AVM surgery as neurosurgeons. And this gives you a good beginning on how best to approach each and every one of them.
Yeah, really a fantastic article. Thank you so much. One last question, Jim, that I've been posing to a lot of our guests on the podcast. In your case, it would be Blue Jays or Maple Leafs?
Thanks. Yeah, so Maple Leafs all the way. We chant in the stadium, go Leafs, go. And the sad thing, however, Paul, is that the last time the Maple Leafs won the Stanley Cup was in 1967.
Right? Oh, my goodness.
That's a major drought.
Bring it back.
You know, Toronto is a place where hockey should be played the best in the world because we have a great farm team here. I don't know what the issue is. And the Blue Jays, I was actually in the stadium when the Blue Jays won the World Series back, I think it was 1991 or so.
Yes.
When Joe Carter hit that magic home run, right? Yeah, I remember that. So we like the Blue Jays too. Yeah. And don't forget, we have the Raptors who won it all for the NBA. So
that's right. I should have added them in for sure.
Well, so we're pretty happy with our teams here in Toronto.
Well, that's awesome. Thanks so much, Jim, for joining us on the podcast. Really appreciate
it. Nice to see you. Thanks again.
You bet. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the AANS podcast. It's Not Brain Surgery. We'll catch you next time. Thank you.